This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So just about every year I discuss our new therapies, new regimens, talk about clinical trials. And in view of the fact that we are in the Napa Valley, I started to realize that, in fact, doing clinical trials is very similar to producing great grapes for wine. You start with a good concept and a good stock. You have to make sure it's planted in the right place and the right soil, that it gets enough sun and air. And so this is the underpinning of a good trial, when you start with a very good idea with solid science behind it. And over the years, we've embraced new regimens and new treatments, because over the years, we realized that, in fact, these have allowed us to be a tiny bit ahead of the curve and provide our patients drugs that were many years ahead of being approved by the FDA, and they certainly benefited from being on those drugs. In terms of interventional trials at UCSF, I'm going to mention just a few ones and go in greater details. And there are four areas that I want briefly to discuss, and then I'll focus primarily on two. One of them is delayed graft function, and I'm going to be discussing it in details because, one, it remains an unmet need, and secondly, there are a number of drugs in clinical trials that are going to address this issue. So we hope that in the near future we'll have a better handle on preventing delayed graft function. The second type of trials we are involved with, and I'm not going to spend much time on this, are the so-called desensitization AMR and treatment of antibody-mediated rejection. Now, we have not been at the forefront of desensitization, because we all felt for a long time that the outcome was not terribly satisfactory, and that we needed better drugs in order to suppress donor-specific antibodies. In terms of antibody-mediated rejection, we are in the process with Alison Weber of treating patients who develop AMR with eculizumab. This is a study in conjunction with the Harvard group, whereby patients who develop AMR are randomized to either standard of care or receiving eculizumab. But those who fail standard of care, then they can be rescued with eculizumab. And so we're really excited about the study and be able to offer our patient eculizumab that potentially could minimize the injury to the kidney. And our main objective with treating AMR is preventing the occurrence of transplant glomerulopathy. Immunomodulation, I'm going to speak quite a bit about that because this is of interest of us. And finally, of course, we continue to be involved with belatacept type trials. We were involved with the phase 2 and phase 3, and in fact, today the American Transplant Congress posted the abstract, and we have the abstract from the phase 3, the 7-year follow-up. And for the first time since the introduction of cyclosporin, a new drug, belatacept, had a significant impact on improving outcome at 7 years. And so our patients at UCSF have had that option to be on belatacept in various trials for now close to maybe 13 years. And we hope that they've clearly benefited from being on belatacept. One of the issues with belatacept is that early on some patients will have histologically more severe rejection. And so we are exploring ways to optimize the early events after transplantation with belatacept, changing induction to thymoglobulin, pairing belatacept maybe with an mTOR inhibitor, in this case everolimus, because there seems to be synergy. And Dr. Stock and Tomljanovic are doing a separate trial supported by the NIH, both in kidney transplant and in kidney pancreas transplant utilizing belatacept. We have an ongoing study on conversion, so patients at 6 months and beyond who are on CNI can be converted to belatacept if they have nephrotoxicity or neurotoxicity and so on. And so we're actively recruiting patients for this study. And then another study that we have been in discussion with a couple of other centers in Bristol-Myers is to have this most simple immunosuppression delivered to the patient, and that's by providing them with monotherapy with belatacept. So we have a lot of patients who were transplanted years ago who are on belatacept, MMF, and prednisone. And what we like to do with immune monitoring, and we're using data generated by Mini Sarwal, a set of genes that can indicate, even predict a patient's risk of rejection. So instead of like the old days that where we withdraw or minimize immunosuppression and hope for the best, this would be a more scientific approach of calibrating a patient's immune risk at every stage of withdrawal of one drug, second drug, and then hopefully be able to maintain the patient on monotherapy. So the clinical trials with delayed graft function, as I said, we're really entering an exciting era of trials in delayed graft function, and there are at least four. Actually, there are other ones. I'm indicating the four that UCSF has been involved. And the first one is carbon monoxide. And now, of course, we all know that carbon monoxide is toxic, although it's a byproduct of heme catabolism. And carbon monoxide actually plays a very important role. It does block pro-inflammatory genes. It does block apoptosis. It does enhance regeneration of renal tubular cells. And so it has been looked experimentally in several models. And in this big model of allotransplantation, the kidneys undergo 60 minutes of warm ischemia time, 24 hours of cold storage time, so basically duplicating what happens to a diseased kidney. Then the kidney is transplanted after bilateral nephrectomy, and then these animals are either given carbon monoxide through the ventilator or regular air, and the animals are immunosuppressed with tacrolimus. And as you can see, that the animals treated with carbon monoxide have lower creatinine. Have lower creatinine and lower BUN, so they recover much faster. Their carbohydroxy levels of hemoglobin are reasonable in terms of the FDA for humans. As long as you are below 14%, it's acceptable. And then, if you look at the air and the carbon monoxide biopsies, the animals that were the controls have interstitial edema, neutrophil infiltration, and tubular necrosis, while the kidney of the carbon monoxide-treated animals is pristine. There are differences in gene expression profiling between the two groups. Again, the gene that are being expressed with the carbon monoxide, like osteopontin, HEOC protein 90 and retinol binding protein, are all genes involved with repair of tissue damage and regeneration. But for example, gene like MCP, a monocyte chemotactic protein that are pro-inflammatory are decreased. And so Sandy Feng actually participated in a study over the past 2 years with carbon monoxide in patients with DGF. The results of the study have not actually been made public, but I know that they were encouraging enough that there seems to be a plan to do a much larger clinical trial. Now, another very interesting molecule that has undergone a large phase 2 trial, and this is a drug from Quark Biotech, and it's a short interfering RNA or silencing RNA, And it suppresses the gene P53, which is a stress response gene. And P53 triggers cellular pathways that induce cell cycle arrest, cell senescence, and apoptosis. And so in experimental study, temporary inhibition at the time of injury of P53 delays the induction of cell death. And so this drug QP1002 actually is found to accumulate very quickly in the renal tubular cells. And based on experimental data, it was felt that it would be protective. And for example, in this rat model, this drug is injected, as you can see on the right side. It goes into the, it is red, it's first in the glomerulus, then it's in Bowman's capsule, and then in figure D, it's taken up, there is an uptake by the tubular cells. And as you can see, it's taken up by the tubular cells, they're all red, and then the half-life is short, so by the 24 hours, it basically disappears. So with this background, a large study was performed. Sandy, again, was one of the co-investigators, and it was presented last year at the World Transplant Congress. Treatment with QPI1002, a short interfering RNA for prophylaxis of delayed graft function. So the author reported the result of this large phase 2 trial in an attempt to suppress P53 to prevent DGF. So 332 patients were randomized 1:1 to a single dose intra-op of either QPI or placebo. And DGF is defined, like in many of these studies, as the need for dialysis in the first week after transplantation. The patients were stratified in various groups, one whether they received a standard kidney or an extended criteria donor, whether the kidney was cold preserved or whether machine preserved. So the pre-transplant DGF risk, there is a DGF risk calculator that pre-transplant can give you an estimate what is the risk of DGF based on donor age, creatinine, recipient age. So there are a number of factors that go into this calculator. So the DGF risk was calculated 35% would be in the QPI and 36% in the placebo. And in fact, DGF occurred in 30% in the drug and 36% in the placebo. This was not significantly different. What was interesting, and where this drug had an effect, that patients who received kidneys from ECD donor and had cold storage had DGF rates lower, 27% versus 39% for placebo. And this was a decrease by 30%. In addition, the patients who got the drug had a shorter duration of dialysis and shorter number of dialysis. And also at one month, they had the GFR, which was higher than the control patients. So at least it looks from this data that not all patients would benefit from the RNA silencing therapy, but that patients who are at high risk of DGF, who get kidneys, let's say, from ECD donors, and these are the ones that may already have higher expression of P53, and so they're more likely to respond to suppression of these genes. So I'm told that a larger phase 3 trial with this drug is going to be planned soon. So there are many pathways for inducing ischemic reperfusion. One of the problems with the previous studies, many of them have failed, is that you have different pathways and multiple tracks to induce injury. And so you block one, the redundancy is such that the other ones overtake the effect and produce DGF. But based on experimental data, complement may be a very early mediator of the injury in DGF. And so data has accumulated that maybe blocking complement may actually prevent delayed graft function. And these are studies in animals showing that, in fact, complement can be found deposited in an experimental situation of ischemia reperfusion. And it may be not the classic pathway that's activated, but the the alternative pathway, as C3B is deposited in these ischemia reperfusion kidneys rather than C4B. And a very interesting study looked at what is the role of complement, which complement is involved in DGF. Is it the circulating vascular pool of complement or the extravascular intrarenal complement within the kidney? So in this study, very interestingly, kidneys from wild-type mouse or mouse that were deficient in C3 were made ischemic and then transplanted in wild-type mice. As you can see, the top figure, the wild-type kidney in the wild-type mouse developed significant DGF, creatinine went up. However, the kidney that came from a C3-deficient animal into the wild-type mouse did not develop much in terms of delayed graft function or ischemia reperfusion injury. So that deficiency within the kidney of complement makes a difference, not in the circulating pool. And as you can see, the histology between the two was quite different. So with this background, of course, using eculizumab, the monoclonal antibody to C5 can interrupt the cascade of complement and injury. And so it was only natural that it should be tried as a potential therapy for the prophylaxis of DGF. And now we're in the midst of a multi-center, multinational trial whereby patients at high risk of DGF, and we calculate the risk when a kidney comes in, if they have a risk of 25% or greater of developing DGF, they are randomized to either placebo, and it's a blinded trial, or at the time of surgery, they get eculizumab, and they get a second infusion 24 hours later, same thing with the placebo. And the primary outcomes are dialysis, GFR, and so on. And so this study is ongoing, and, you know, hopefully within a year, we'll find out whether a discrete and focused approach in blocking complement can, in fact, prevent delayed graft function. Now, in many of studies of kidneys that have been retrieved for organ donation, when people have done gene expression profiling of these kidneys, they have found that in many kidneys, even before the reperfusion, at the ischemia level when the kidney is still in cold storage, that there is high expression of inflammatory genes and for example, TNF-alpha. And so the group at Mount Sinai got an NIH grant called CTOT-19 to, in fact, test whether at the time of transplantation, if patients are treated with infliximab, which is a chimeric antibody to TNF-alpha as compared to placebo, whether one that would prevent the inflammatory genes in the kidney when it's reperfused, and number two, whether it decreases the incidence of DGF, and because you're blocking the genes for inflammation, whether long-term, it may affect renal function, and we're going to be participating in this study. So finally, I'd like to talk about our approach to modulating the immune system, because, you know, clearly if you could modulate and reorient the immune system, you just don't treat an acute event, but you allow the immune system to cohabit with the allograft for a long time, and that point you're able to minimize immunosuppression. So one of the frequent questions we're asked is why UCSF is not currently participating in those tolerance studies with bone marrow and kidney trials. And I want, in short, to just give you a summary of where we are in that and part of the reason why we may not be involved in them. So there are three major centers that have attempted at inducing tolerance with stem cells or bone marrow. Stanford has been a long-term leader in that with Sam Strober using total lymphoid irradiation as a conditioning agent, as a conditioning therapy. The problem with that is that most of the studies so far have been done in HLA identical. And then in those patients, drug withdrawal in many of those patients was feasible. But HLA identical tend to be a different type of patients. They can tolerate minimization and with little immunosuppression and still do quite well. So Stanford has done a number of mismatch patients, and they are in the process, they haven't done yet, of starting to withdraw drugs. And I think we have to see whether they're able, in fact, to withdraw drugs in the mismatch patients. Now, many years ago, Peter Salk actually participated in a similar protocol with Stanford, and we had a couple of patients that were enrolled in the study, and they were mismatched patients, and those patients had rejection. So we have been somewhat skeptical about this approach. The second approach is the MGH, and the MGH has worked for many years, both in non-human primates in inducing tolerance as well as in human. And they have a protocol that started with total irradiation, anti-CD2 antibodies, bone marrow, kidney transplant. They had a couple of patients who developed donor-specific antibodies and rejection. Then they added 2 doses of Rituxan. That was not enough. Then they added 4 doses of rituximab. And so it's still an issue whether you can induce, and these are haplotype mismatch, whether they can induce tolerance in these patients. One thing that occurs with their protocol is that there is a syndrome called the engraftment syndrome, where after the transplant, the kidney undergoes AKI and recovers very slowly. And so between the engraftment syndrome and AMR, I think this protocol still needs work. And finally, there is a Northwestern approach using bone marrow, but then also infusing a very special cell called the facilitator cell. And the facilitator cell is a cell that can do 2 things. One, improve engraftment of the bone marrow or the stem cells, and number 2, prevent graft versus host disease. And, you know, the Northwestern initial experience appears to be pretty promising. Now, again, Peter Salk used the same facilitator cell from the same lab, and many years ago we tried it in a couple of patients, and our experience was not very good. So the major concerns about stem cells, bone marrow, and kidney is the following. In each group, there is not clear-cut proof, do you need chimerism or not? The MGH and Stanford chimerism can occur for a short time, but even if it disappears, the patient remains tolerant. In the Northwestern group, chimerism is absolutely necessary, and if they lose chimerism, they do not become tolerant. And in fact, in the Northwestern group with the bone marrow and facilitator cell infusions, they develop like 100% chimerism, which It's usually regarded as being potentially dangerous because of the risk of graft versus host. Although, to be frank, they have not reported any such cases. Anyway, we look at these quite warily, and we're still concerned that, you know, these are still experimental protocols, not ready for prime time. And that's one of the many reasons why occasionally I get a call as to how come we are not doing tolerance-inducing studies. I think we're going in a direction which may be more conservative. It's to try to modulate the immune system to minimize immunosuppression. And again, trying to harness the body's ability to control immune responses. And one of our interests is to try to target basically the T regulatory cell so that it can control the alloimmune responses. And so there could be an era of T-reg therapies, and basically what are T-regs? T-regs are a small subset of T-cells, maybe 5% of CD4 cells. They have distinguishing self-surface characteristics, and they have a factor called the FOXP3 that gives them both their characteristic and their functionality. The main function of T-regs is to suppress immune responses by either preventing unwarranted immune activation, autoimmune diseases, or resolving immune responses to limit collateral tissue damage. It is known that if you lose the transcription factor FOXP3, or you have a mutation, then that can lead to local autoimmunity because you then lose the regulatory process. So if one looks at how do Treg function, most of the time the Treg function as homeostatic control, meaning they make sure that there aren't any wayward T effector autoreactive T cells that start getting activated. So as soon as they start releasing some IL-2, the Treg that has a CD25 receptor for IL-2 will suck up all the IL-2 and basically deprive the effector cells from the IL-2, which is required for further activation and proliferation. Now, if this area is breached and there is an attack and there is tissue damage, one of the things that happens to Treg is that they shed a ligand, CD62. They are able then to migrate to areas of tissue injury. And then at that point, they interact with the antigen-presenting cell or the dendritic cells, and they release, for example, latent TGF-beta, which has immunosuppressive properties. They can release cytotoxic granules that can kill effector cells, and therefore they start to limit the ongoing damage. And then there is a so-called infectious tolerance, which is the next step, whereby Tregs induce and sort of educate either naive T cells or effector cells to become Treg cells. And therefore, they can then better control the immune response and get back to a normal homeostatic state. And so, experimentally, Tregs play these important roles, and that can be obviously shown in various studies. And this is one study in mouse transplants with islet cells showing that if you infuse Treg, especially if you give an alkylating agent to deplete effector cells, so there is always a balance between effector cells and Tregs, that you can induce prolonged survival of the islet cells. Now, here there are two types of Tregs that are infused: polyclonal Tregs, or actually antigen-specific Tregs. And the antigen-specific Tregs tend to be more powerful than the polyclonal Tregs. This is experimentally. We don't know in humans whether that is the case. But at UCSF, we're actually becoming a Treg center because several studies are underway to determine the role of Tregs in controlling the immune response and their ability maybe to induce a state of tolerance. DART is a study that Dr. Kang is involved with. This is basically actually a study sponsored by the European Community, whereby living donor recipients who are getting kidney from a living donor, before the transplant, they get an infusion of donor-specific Tregs, and then they get the kidney transplant, and hopefully with the infusion of donor-specific Tregs, they require over a period of time less immunosuppression. Delta and Artemis are two studies that are going to be performed in liver transplant, again with the objective to minimize and withdraw drugs. And I think the biggest study is the one we're involved with. It's called TASC. And this is a study supported by the NIH. And we plan to enroll 30 patients. And so these 30 patients are patients who are recruited at the time of the 6 months management biopsy, protocol biopsy, 6 months biopsy. So these patients at 6 months would have inflammation or subclinical rejection. So our plan, since we know that Tregs have the ability to actually migrate to areas of inflammation and suppress the immune response, we're going to take these patients at 6 months who have inflammation in the kidney and infuse them with Treg cells. And we're going to have one group receive polyclonal Tregs, another group actually as we grow the T-rex, we grow them in the presence of the donor antigen, so they're going to be donor antigen reactive or specific. And then we're going to biopsy these patients a few weeks later to see, one, whether we have controlled the inflammation completely, and number two, whether the T-rex that we have injected have actually found their way to the kidney. And we can actually determine that because we grow the T-rex with deuterium, which is incorporated in the glucose of DNA, and it's approved for use in humans. So before we start this large NIH trial, we wanted to try it in two patients in a pilot way. And so this is just to show you what we do. We take a unit of blood from the recipient. So out of the 450 cc's, we isolate maybe 400 to 500 million mononuclear cells. About 1% or so will be T-regs. We isolate the T-regs, and then we expose them to beads to allow them to proliferate times two. So we hope they can proliferate maybe 1,000 to 3,000 times. We make sure to select the T-rex on that basis. And then 2 weeks later, we infuse them in the patient. Now, if we were to actually infuse antigen-specific or reactive T-rex cells, when we are growing the T-reg cells, we expose them to donor B cells, and therefore these will be T-regs that are specific to donor antigens. We don't know in humans whether the polyclonal versus the antigen-reactive T-regs, which is better, which is safer, and so on. So we tried the polyclonal in two patients, and of course I'm going to show you the better of the two. But in this patient had, before the infusion, had, as you can see, inflammation and tubulitis. We got a unit of blood, we isolated T-rex, we infused the patient with 320 million of T-rex. 2 weeks later, we biopsied the patient on the right side, and 2 weeks later, Dr. Lasek, our pathologist, could not find any mononuclear cells and no tubulitis. So this looked good. Of course, a critique of this is that occasionally these changes can be local and focal. But of course, you know, we're going to have tissue to look at gene expression profiling. We have urine, etc. So hopefully, as we start in the fall, our large study will be able to determine what is the role of T-reg in transplantation and whether, in fact, it's a therapy that potentially could lead to a state of tolerance or minimal immunosuppression. So patients 6 months who have inflammation, we're not going to treat patients who have, we're not going to enroll patients who have rejection, only patients who have inflammation. The reason for that is, first of all, these inflammatory cells over the long term can deteriorate kidney function, and yet we don't have good therapy for these patients. So the patient is going to be then randomized to three groups, the control group, the other two groups, one group will receive polyclonal T-regs, the other group will receive donor-reactive T-regs. We biopsy them 2 weeks later and then 6 months later to see, in fact, if the T-regs that we have infused have migrated to the kidney, number one. Two, whether they've controlled the inflammatory response. And, in fact, if they do that, then we can gradually decrease their calcineurin inhibitors and put them on something like an mTOR inhibitor or everolimus. And so this is a cellular therapy, a roundabout way to actually potentially produce the same thing, and this is a second part of our CETUS study, is to use a drug called tocilizumab, which is an anti-IL-6 receptor antibody. And the reason why we target IL-6, because IL-6 has a couple of... First of all, this drug is approved for rheumatoid arthritis, but IL-6 plays a very important role in the immune system because it activates and expands the effector network, especially Th17, and suppresses T-reg cells. And in fact, in experimental models where IL-6 is either blocked or the animals do not produce IL-6, they have much higher levels of effectors of Treg cells, and these Treg cells have even greater suppressor activity. So our approach, one, is to infuse Tregs, to increase the Tregs. The second approach is pharmacologic, to give these patients with inflammation tocilizumab and see whether, in fact, the inflammation goes away, and as importantly, determine whether we have modified the immune response. And we know that IL-6 is important. This is a slide from Zoltan, Dr. Lasek. This is inside the hybridization of IL-6, and we see that D is a normal, there is no IL-6. C is somebody with just borderline rejection. But A and B are patients who have a type 1A rejection, and the dark dots are the ones that are present in both mononuclear cells and the renal tubular cells. And so we know that with rejection, IL-6 is present, and so we hope to be able to block it. But we're not only interested in blocking this inflammation. What we're really after is a reorientation of the immune system. So the T-REX study, when it starts, is going to be for recipient of living donor transplant. The tocilizumab trial will be for patients who receive kidneys from deceased donors. And this is a protocol for tocilizumab. So patients, deceased donor recipient at 6 months who have subclinical rejection or inflammation will be, first of all, we get a piece of the kidney for mRNA and determine whether they have a common rejection module. These are a set of 11 genes that Mini Sarwal has reported to be associated with rejection, and we stratify them whether they have it or they don't. And then we treat them with either tocilizumab or placebo, and then we see whether, in fact, not only the inflammation has gone away, but whether we have been able to change the gene expression from pro-inflammatory to pro-tolerant. And so as I started the first slide, I said, clinical trials are like vines are making wine. And so the stomping of the grapes is the process of doing the trial, enrolling patients, getting data, and so on. And everything works well. You get great results. Patients are safe. You get a nice p-value. You publish the paper. And that's, at the end, the bottle of wine. You get it. You taste the wine. You say, boy, that was a pretty good year. And so I hope you all have a nice year. Any questions? Yes.
In the T-REX studies, you emphasize mostly histological changes that you follow. How about the functional changes, the functioning of the kidneys? Then, if you're going to follow that, obviously you're going to. What method would you use?
Yeah, we will be following a calculated GFR. I mean, that's one of the important endpoints. So there is a histologic endpoint. There is a mechanistic endpoint where we look at changes in the blood, in the kidney, and the urine of pro-inflammatory genes. And there is also the functional element, and we hope that we will be able to differentiate the two groups, those treated and not treated, by GFR at 2 years. Whether that period of time is enough to give us that separation, we don't know, but that's what we hope. So we hope to be able to demonstrate in these three areas, the histologic, the mechanistic, and the functional differences between the groups. Okay. So, yeah, please go ahead.
Specific biomarkers or determinants as to what kind of a novel immunosuppression you use in a given patient?
Well, this is the new era in transplantation, and the next thing is to to personalize medicine. I mean, you know, this is a buzzword that is used right and left, right? Personalized medicine or precision medicine. And of course, the oncologists have had tremendous success in doing that. And one of the speakers today, Mini Sarwal, will address this specific issue about how do we go about to personalizing medicine. In transplantation, this hasn't occurred, but I think going forward, we're going to see greater examples in clinical trials where there's going to be an effort to personalize medicine, because I think we realize it's not like one drug or one regimen is good for all. And if we can tailor the drugs and also tailor which who are the patients on whom we can withdraw drugs, it would be fantastic. The problem, so far, we use the drugs, and if they do well, we celebrate. If they don't do well, we say, okay, well, you know, that wasn't the right drug for the patient. But I think the era of personalized medicine and transplantation is around the corner, and Mini Sarwal will be discussing that this afternoon. In terms of the occasionally, I mean, in the DGF trials, I showed there are four. Fortunately, very for the DGF, frequently we may have at that point one trial ongoing, and so you know we put patients in those. Otherwise, if we have let's say two competing drugs, what we do we. You know, some drugs require more frequent visits and more intense monitoring. And if the patient's coming from far, from Fresno, from Salinas, et cetera, where this would be a burden, and there is another DGF trial that may require one infusion at the time of surgery, and the follow-up would be consistent with, let's say, standard of care, we would then, you know, strategize in that manner. Occasionally, if we have two competing trials and an educated and individual, we can talk to the patient and tell them, okay, we have these two agents, we can use them and tell them about them. In the past, I have found that a patient comes in for a transplant, and if you start giving them these choices of one trial, another trial, different drugs, side effects, you really increase their anxiety. And so I think what you need to do is know the history of the patient, know their socioeconomic status, know what is their transportation issues, know what kind of follow-up, and so on, and then make the best possible decision for the patient. I mean, maybe in general terms mention that there could be alternatives, but then present with one scenario rather than giving them three choices and they become quite confused about it. But this is an important issue. It has come back before. But, you know, I think we have to make the very best effort to see what regimen or what trial the patient fits best that particular patient.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.